Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. I'm excited on this one because we have not done enough on this topic. So I don't think we've done anything on this topic in almost 2 years of being a podcast. So Zach, it's about time. You're in charge of scheduling. I'm blaming you.
That's nice, but I'm going to just fire the blame straight back at you because you did the scheduling for the first year.
No, Alina did, to be fair. Let's blame Alina. She's okay. Not here.
It's Alina's fault. So in her absence, we will dump the blame on Alina's
door. Yeah, she did the same to us. It's fair game.
Okay. Before we create like a massive rift within the History Hack leadership, we're doing the Crimean War today, or an element of it. So we have Mai Tro with us, who's a true crime and crime fiction writer. He's the author of The Pocket Hercules, a biography of William Morris, who led the 17th Lancers in the very famous Charge of the Light Brigade. But today we're going to talk about something that kind of is going to sound like you've heard of it, but actually you haven't, because we're going to talk about the Charge of the Heavy Brigade, Scarlet's 300 in the Crimea, which is the title of Mai's book. Mai, welcome to History Hack. Great to see you.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this. Shall we start with the real basics here? Because we've talked about already, we kind of alluded to it, the Charge of the Light Brigade, made famous, of course, by the Tennyson poem. It's effectively part of certainly British military folklore, if not just kind of military history folklore generally. But who are the Heavy Brigade, and where do the two kind of slot together?
Yeah, the British cavalry were divided into two, the heavies and the lights. You might think that's based on weight, but that's totally irrelevant. It's a traditional thing dating from the late 17th century when the British Army was created. What you've got are the light cavalry composed of hussars, lancers, and light dragoons. They were supposed to be used for foraging, for scouting, for that kind of work, checking ahead of the main body of an army for the presence of an enemy and so on. And the heavy brigade were supposed to do the heavy stuff. They were supposed to charge in battle and smash the hell out of the enemy. It didn't work out like that. Both brigades actually behaved in the same way. They did the same thing. There was no distinction between them. They looked very different. The heavy brigade, about which I wrote, wore brass helmets and scarlet tunics. If you saw what is one of my favorite films of all time, Tony Richardson's The Charge of the Light Brigade, you will have seen brief glimpses of the heavy brigade wearing dark blue. Whoops, be-bomb, a number of gaffes that the filmmakers made.
Sometimes they make them on purpose. I don't like red. Blue's my favorite color, so I went with it. And the historical, oh my God. You know, Josh Levine, my dear, dear friend, was the historical advisor on Dunkirk. He was like, you can't have a yellow nose cone on that Messerschmitt.
Sure.
Was just like, it's iconic and I want it. And there's Josh getting beaten for not knowing the stuff.
Absolutely. Like, oh. Yeah, I'm sure that's right. And it is all very well for historical advisors to pontificate, but I think when you're a director and you've got a tight budget and a very small space in terms of time, you've just got to get on with the story, haven't you, really?
Yeah, I think Josh's takeaway was, I learned to pick my battles.
I love it. That's very good. I shall use that.
Can I ask a really nerdy question about weaponry here? Because I'm thinking about this with a Napoleonic hat on, and the equipment is different, right? For back in inverted commas, my period, for light cavalry and heavy cavalry, i.e.
Yeah.
Saber for light cavalry, generally speaking, is curved.
Yep.
Heavy cavalry saber that they're using at that point is basically a, and it looks a bit like an extended meat cleaver, if we're being really honest. It's a very brutal
In the Napoleonic period, that's true. Any fans of Sharp out there will know that, for reasons of his own, Sharp carried a heavy cavalry sword, and they are vicious, horrible things. I got a small collection of swords, and sadly, that is not one of them. But by the Crimean period, that's changed, that's gone. We have a new pattern, the 1834 so-called honeysuckle hilt, which is very similar to the three-bar hilt carried by the lights. There is a slight curve in the blade. They were designed to be used for thrusting with the point, and also hacking with the one side of the blade. So you'd be a bit hard put to tell which is which, really. As I was saying earlier, there is little distinction between light and heavy, certainly in terms of the weaponry that they carried. NCOs and officers carried pistols as well, often privately purchased. The other ranks were issued with carbines, short muskets, converted to rifles at about that time, but they didn't like them. They were clumsy, difficult to load, especially from the saddle with one hand while you're holding the reins. And so they tended to rely on the sword instead. In the case of lancers, of course, the lance.
So is there a lot of kind of investment in the history then? Do you see people being quite jealous of their tradition as a member of the light cavalry and sort of members of the heavy cavalry, sort of the recipients of banter and vice versa about, oh, you know, the heavies, you know, you don't want to be part of the heavies, and so on and so forth?
Yes, there was an awful lot of that. You've got to remember that the officer class are actually a pretty unimpressive bunch, to be honest. They're public school boys. They're very petty. They're very jealous of traditions and their own status. For example, when the heavy brigade charged, Lord Cardigan, who commanded the light, said, "Those damned heavies will have the laugh on us this day." He was really annoyed that Scarlett's 300 had gone in there before he did. So there was a great deal of the them and us going on, yes.
So we are going to cut back and talk about what the hell Britain are doing in the Crimea. But while you've mentioned one of the men, let's just talk about, you've got some main characters in your book, haven't you? So who are they and what have their careers and experiences been like up until this point?
Well, if we look at the heavy brigade, the commander was James Scarlett, who was 56 when he led the charge of the heavy brigade. Now, he had never fought a battle in his life before. You have to remember, we have what's called the Long Peace. That's the period from 1815, Waterloo, up to 1854, when there were no major European engagements at all in which Britain was involved. We had experience in India, but the number of regiments in India were very few, and many people, again, like our dear friend Lord Cardigan, despised Indian officers simply because they were experienced and he, by comparison, was an amateur. So James Scarlett was an amateur too, and yet it didn't show on the day. His behaviour and the way he led his brigade was absolutely immaculate. Under him, he had two experienced men, and that's all. One was a man called Beatson, who was a bit of a freelance. He was on Scarlett's staff, but he'd served in India and he'd run his own irregular cavalry out there. The irregulars didn't do exactly as they liked, but they certainly didn't conform to British regulations. So he was experienced. He'd fought in various Indian conflicts, knew what he was doing. The other one, a much younger man in his 20s, was Alexander Elliott, who was Scarlett's ADC. His job was to carry orders, basically, for Scarlett, and he rode right behind him in the charge itself. I feel sorry for Alex Elliott because he wore a staff officer's cocked hat with a plume. And he said to his CO, "Look, do you mind if I don't wear this? Because it's a bit of a target with this plume on my head." Bearing in mind, Scarlett himself wore a brass helmet, which gave some protection. And Scarlett refused. "So no, I'm not going to have my officers dressed scruffily. You will wear the cap you're supposed to wear." As a result, Elliot got 6 wounds to the head, and he was extremely lucky to survive. One of them almost took off his nose. And of course, the scars stayed with him for the rest of his life.
Oh, and I'm guessing Scarlett never again got a Christmas card from him.
I'm guessing he didn't.
Just welcome to the top of my shit list.
Well, you say that, but to be fair to Scarlett, he was an enormously popular man. His troops loved him, unlike unlike Cardigan, whose officers despised him. So you in the light brigade and the heavy brigade, you've got Cardigan, who is the devil incarnate, really, totally misbehaving for most of his life, doing what the hell he liked, regardless of who opposed him. And you've got Scarlett, who, on the contrary, did his job, did it well, and was really concerned for his men.
So we are going to get to the charges because they form part of the Battle of Balaclava, but we kind of need to just give people a vague sense. And I suspect that we might end up asking you back to cover Crimea properly in the future. But we do need to give folks a vague sense of sort of what happens and how we get to Balaclava. So how does Britain end up becoming involved in the Crimean War? And then in turn, how do we get to Balaclava itself? Because this has always struck me as quite a kind of messy period. And Britain and France working together in a war. This is not known in the 19th century. And I do remember people telling me anecdotes of how the commanders in the British Army are getting very confused about, okay, we're going to go and attack the French. No, 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 sir. Oops. You're allied with the French. Are those true?
Yes, they are. They are. Yeah, we'd fought the French for 1,000 years by the 19th century. So to be on the same side as they were was quite bizarre. Lord Raglan, the commander of the British Army, was 70. Now, I'm 72, but the poor old boy was a little bit more gaga even than I am. And he did occasionally confuse the two. So he would say you'd refer to the enemy as the French to be reminded that they were actually the Russians this time. That said, the French and British didn't do much together. To be honest, they tended to fight their own separate wars, even though they were on the same side. How do we get to the Crimea? Well, the causes of the Crimean War are incredibly complicated, and we don't have time to go into those, which I'm eternally grateful because they are so complicated. But from the British point of view, it was straightforward. Basically, we have Russia flexing its muscles. Now, I don't want to get political, but we have a tendency for that to be happening again, do we not? It's a cyclical thing in Russian history. It's nothing to do with communism or anything like that. It's to do with the fact that the Russians have an expansionist policy. They like to push their weight around. And they were doing so in the 1850s at the expense of the Turkish Empire, the sick man of Europe, which was tottering. It was decrepit. It was old. It was dysfunctional. And it was weak by comparison with Russia. So Russia wants to expand to the south, and Turkey is in the way. And if we let that happen, if Britain allowed the Russians to kick the Turks aside, then that means the Russians will come out of the Black Sea, through the Dardanelles, into the Mediterranean. And the Mediterranean is sort of British by the 1850s. Even more, it's our way to India. And India, of course, cliche, the brightest jewel in the imperial crown. We've got to stop that from happening. There was no Suez Canal until 1869, but the quickest overland route to India was across the desert to the Red Sea. If the Russians controlled Egypt and controlled the Red Sea, then we wouldn't be able to do that. So we have to stop the Russians. Now, nobody in 1854 in Britain considered the idea of an invasion of Russia. Napoleon had tried that in 1812 with disastrous results. Of 600,000 men in the Grande Armée, only 40,000 came back. So you don't mess with Russia, because Russia has two of the most brilliant generals in the world, January and February, and you can't mess with the weather. So at least the British government in the 1850s recognized that. And so the idea is, quote, to give the Russian bear a bloody nose. In other words, you just want to annoy the Russians and make the point that we're not allowing them to trample all over Turkey. So why not knock out the naval base at Sevastopol in the Crimea? Because that will give the bear the bloody nose. And that's what we did. We sent the fleet with French support and, of course, the Turks as well. And we landed in the Crimea. We got to Balaclava, which was the nearest harbour to Sevastopol itself. Notice, by the way, I'm giving it the correct Ukrainian pronunciation there. Now, I will said Sebastopol, but it's now Sebastopol because I've been there.
I think the trick is with Russian pronunciation, if you're English, is always put the emphasis on the syllable that feels uncomfortable.
And yeah, exactly so.
Like a piss take, but that is exactly how you do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no, you're spot on, spot on. Yeah, that's it. So the Allied troops landed in the Crimea. They fought a battle at the Alma River on the 20th of September, which was largely an infantry slog. The heavy brigade hadn't even got to the Crimea by that time. And then they did the flank march. They marched south, skirting Sebastopol, and got to Balaclava, which became their base for the rest of the war. And so that is where the action took place.
So Balaclava has three main phases to it, as I understand. And when we get to your heavy brigade charge, that's the middle. Yeah. So what happens in the early part of the battle?
In the early part of the battle, there were a series of forts called redoubts. There were six of them that were built on hills called the Causeway Heights, overlooking Sebastopol. And these were manned by Turks. Sorry, that's my doorbell going. I do apologise.
I love it. It's not a real horse. Okay. That's so, do you know what? Look, it's so it. On point for the topic yeah. as well. I'm not
heavy brigade, I bring my own horses.
When I'm mentally thinking, I know this guy lives on the Isle of Wight a lot of the time.
Oh, no
so,
problem.
You know, I'm not aware of a huge, like, cavalry brigade being just positioned out there.
Just history hack first.
Don't tell the RSPCA about the horse in my lounge here. Okay. Where was I? Boxers out there. What was I talking
you
about?
You say that just whilst you're gathering yourself. I live in a dodgy part of Bournemouth, and we have the New Forest on our doorstep. And on occasion, we were hearing a lot of horse whining. And we just assumed that, you know, it was a kid had got a new toy and was, you know, prancing around being My Little Pony or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Until my mum looked out the window and then just went to me, Zach, a neighbour's got a horse in their garden. And I went, what? And she said, no, seriously, come and look. And I kid you not, it was one of these New Forest ponies that we reckon one of the, not God. Our direct neighbour,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
somebody
sure.
further down the road. And, just decided was they were going to abduct and try and yeah. sell on. It was the most bizarre thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
Anywho,
back to Balaclava. Yeah, on the 25th of October, 1854, the Russians attacked those forts. They'd been built by the Royal Engineers, manned by the Turks. The first fort held out for about an hour. In the meantime, Lord Raglan, the British commander-in-chief, orders his infantry to go and stop that attack. Unfortunately, the infantry were very, very slow, very sluggish that morning. They were quite a way away, something like 3 or 4 miles. Therefore, the nearest unit that could have stopped the Russian advance were just two regiments, the 42nd and 93rd Highlanders, led by Colin Campbell. And they were the ones who stopped that initial Russian advance. One of the many people watching that stage of the battle, the first phase, was William Howard Russell of the Times. He was the first ever war correspondent, and he described the action as the thin red streak, because they were a tiny red line against this mass of grey-coated Russian cavalry. Now, over time, the thin red streak morphed into the thin red line, which, of course, became synonymous with British heroism from then on, really. And the 93rd and the 42nd held off the Russians. I must just tell you an amusing little story about that. The Turks ran away. The Turks were not impressive in this phase of the war at all. And rather than face those Russians, they left the Highlanders to it and they ran. And they ran past the Highlanders' camp, where the wives of the regiment, of course, were watching anxiously. And one of them was so incensed by the Turks running away that she grabbed hold of one of them by the scruff of his neck and effectively beat him up for deserting her husband. He was horrified and kept apologizing in his broken English, but she wasn't having any of that. And she belted him until he fell over, covered in blood. And I thought, that's just great. You know,
yeah, I love
this
her.
Is, womankind doing.
Do we know who she was?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I can't remember her name.
Oh, that's cool. It's like,
she survived. She survived the war, as did her husband. Brilliant. And she became a national heroine, of course, when she went back to Scotland. She was feted and applauded. And quite right, too, I think. Good stuff. So that was the first phase of the battle over. But, of course, the Russians were still carting away the guns from the forts. Now, Duke of Wellington had never lost a gun in his entire career. And Lord Raglan, the commander-in-chief, had been Wellington's secretary back at Waterloo. So he was very close to the great man. And the thought of losing a gun appalled him. So at all costs, those guns must be rescued. Those forts must be saved. And the nearest unit to do that was Scarlet's Heavy Brigade.
So the Heavy Brigade go in. You've just talked about the aims here, you know, recover that artillery at all costs. How successful are they? How complicated an operation is that? You know, what are we talking about in terms of quality on the Russian side? And with the best will in the world, you can, you know, chase off the Russians trying to drag off those guns. But, you know, these horses are not equipped for draft work. They're not, you know, you can't just hitch the gun to a horse and carry it back to the redoubt. So how does that all play out?
Well, the Heavy Brigade didn't get anywhere near those redoubts because there was a massive body of cavalry between them. They were a composite lot of hussars and Cossacks. Now, the Cossacks, the Russian light cavalry, became legendary later. They were already legendary, but they adopted a political stance, really, because they were used as policemen by various czars to keep the people in their place. Now, the Cossacks were universally detested. In fact, they had saved Russia in earlier centuries from Polish attacks and God knows what. And they were freelance horsemen. They came from the steppes. They were brilliant riders, but they were not well equipped. They were not well trained. They fought very much in an undisciplined, haphazard way. The Russian hussars, regular cavalry, were much more on a par with what they were facing. So Scarlet's first problem is to get through them before he can even reach the forts. The quality of the Russian fighting man was not great. As a military historian, I'm afraid I've always thought this. That the same thing applies to both world wars in my book. They were certainly slaughtered in their thousands. In World War II, Stalin sends them in irregardless. He doesn't care about numbers of casualties. But as fighting men, they're not marvelous. One man who was with the Russian army in the Crimea was Tolstoy, the later great writer. And he lamented the fact, having spoken to British prisoners during the war, he said, why is it that the British are so proud of their heritage? They're proud of themselves, they're proud of their army, they're proud of what they do, and our men aren't. Our men are pathetic. Well, his men were serfs. Until 1861, there was legal slavery in Russia, and therefore most of the ordinary soldiers were literally slaves. They had no status whatsoever. Their pay was abysmal. Their weapons were incredibly average, but they did outnumber Scarlet's men 3-1. And that was Scarlet's problem. He charged, first of all, on his own volition. He got no orders from above at all, with just two units. These were his 300. They were the 2nd and 6th Dragoons, the Scots Greys and the Inniskillings. And if you look at most of the art from the charge, the Scots Greys are always shown because they're so colourful. They were the only unit to wear tall bearskin headgear as opposed to the brass helmets. And of course, they all rode grey horses. So they must have been an incredibly striking appearance as they charged. Very rapidly, the other units of the Heavy Brigade, that's the 4th and 5th Dragoon Guards, and the rest of the 6th Dragoons and the 1st Royal Dragoons joined in. So eventually, the Heavy Brigade is made up of the best part of 1,000 men, and they're all charging uphill, which cavalry are not really supposed to do, against this mass of Russian men. To begin with, they had to stumble over the tent ropes of the Light Brigade because that's where it all happened. So you have at least one man, a guy called Neville, an officer in the 4th Dragoon Guards who fell off his horse because the animal tripped on these tent ropes and down he went. He was killed, unfortunately, later in the charge. So it was a difficult piece of ground. What did it achieve? It terrified the Russians. They couldn't believe that this small unit was actually hitting them and going right through them. The people who watched from the hills saw this happen and thought, well, that's it. They're all going to die. Scarlet will never be seen again. He's lost in this mass of grey coats. And suddenly he's out the other side with his men behind him. It was an incredible success.
See, it's interesting you mentioned about how the Scots Greys are always picked up. And apologies to listeners for the Waterloo anecdote here, but it perhaps ties into their pedigree, doesn't it? Because when you think about the charge of the Union and Heavy Cavalry Brigades at Waterloo, what do we think of? We think of that beautiful painting by Lady Butler, Scotland Forever, of the Scots Greys again. Yeah. So perhaps it's because of that and sort of trying to sort of tell a tale of regimental history as well.
Sure. I think since you mentioned that, charge at Waterloo was probably not delivered at the full gallop, as we always believe. Yeah. Lady Butler's painting shows full gallop. The Waterloo films show full gallop. But in fact, in the early stages, the Highlanders, the infantry, were hanging onto the stirrup leathers of the men, actually being carried along between the horsemen. I've never seen stuntmen daring to do that, but it did happen. And it could only have happened if the horses were moving relatively slowly.
And there's also a point about muddy ground as well, but you know, let's not go into
Absolutely.
This is interesting. So they basically charge on through. Is that a case of momentum? Are they not seen coming, or is this a case of, look, these guys are just better trained, they're better equipped, they have a better kind of internal discipline and morale, and so it's that ends up becoming the force multiplier in this circumstance?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. It is that training. They drilled and drilled and drilled on the parade ground for every eventuality. What they didn't do was to do proper, what we'd now call war games. Very few regiments before the Crimea actually met together in a brigade formation to carry out the realistic examples of warfare by using hedges and ditches and that kind of thing. It was all parade ground stuff, but it worked. The men were drilled to the extent that they knew exactly what to do and when to do it. And the stories of heroism are just extraordinary, of guys helping each other out in the most bizarre circumstances. And with any military action, there's an element of luck. And I think luck was definitely with Scarlet that day.
I'm just struck by what you say about the lack of wargaming as well, because it reminds me of, and apologies, listeners, another Napoleonic thing, but I'm curious about the continuity here. So there is this charge that Wellington makes about how the cavalry have got into this head, this habit of charging at everything. And that's part of the reason why you see this at Salamanca, particularly when the British cavalry charge in and they overextend themselves. It obviously very famously happens at Waterloo, but the same thing happens and the British cavalry ends up being cut off by French dragoons and lancers. You talked earlier about how Scarlet didn't have orders. Is this part of that same kind of tradition that the cavalry see and they do, and there's just this kind of tendency for impetuousness that during the Napoleonic era ends in absolute disaster, but by fortuitous circumstances for the British doesn't end up in the same thing here? But then, you know, important code to this, we're going to talk about the charge of the Light Brigade, where, you know, very different set of circumstances. Is this a continuity of that trend, would you say?
Yeah, it is very much. And you can see it, first of all, way back in the English Civil War with Prince Rupert and his cavaliers. You charge at anything. That's what you do. You charge at full pelt, hell for leather, at the gallop, and you smash the enemy off the field. So there's very little thought involved, very little maneuver. You simply go in there. In the 18th century, one of the best commanders was Frederick of Prussia, Frederick the Great. And one of his standing orders was an officer awaiting an attack shall be court-martialed. In other words, you don't stand to see what's going to happen. You make it happen. You are the mover and shaker. Get in there, do it. Now, remember, Scarlett had no experience of this. He'd never done it before, but that must have been instilled in him probably as a child. This is how you behave. This is what you do. You go for it, and devil take the hindmost, basically.
I have to ask, why do you think this has been forgotten? Is it the impact of Tennyson wittering on? We know I'm not a poetry fan. Or is there more to it?
The Tennyson poem is incredibly important. There was a time in schools, and I know that time is long gone, when kids would learn this, that they would recite it. You know, half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. It's gutsy stuff. And he wrote that in December 1854. The dispatches, the information from the Crimea, didn't get through until November, published in the Times, Russell's paper. And so impressed was he by what had happened, that Tennyson went into print. So that poem actually does carry a great deal of significance. Can I just quote, though, from George Orwell, which is a kind of bizarre step. In 1940, Orwell said, "The most stirring battle poem in English is about a brigade of cavalry which charged in the wrong direction." i.e. the Light Brigade. And that's the thing about the British. We love disasters. We love shock and horror. We love the most depressing stories imaginable. Again, I don't want to get political, but can I mention a little thing called COVID? Dying of and dying with, you know, all the stats that have come out from various government departments. We've seen this lockdown. Oh my God, no, we're all going to die. This is something that is part of human psyche. And it's true of battles as well. If you have a battle that is a success, or part of a battle that is a success, at Balaclava, you had two successes. Campbell's Highlanders and Scarlett's Heavy Brigade. They worked very well. They were very efficient. They stopped the Russian advance. But that's not what we remember. We remember the cock-up that followed the Light Brigade. And I think it really is part of human nature.
I mean, you see that. I know Alex doesn't like the poetry, but this is one of those, and I'm often with the boss, actually, on that. Poetry isn't really my thing. Sorry, listeners. But I do make an exception for a few, and Charge of the Light Brigade is one of them. And it does, as you say, kind of tap into that incompetence thing, that one of the most quoted bits, there's not to make reply, there's not to reason why, there's but to do and die.
And die, absolutely.
Yep. Into the valley of death rode the 600. And it's that, look, somebody's made an absolute howler, sure. But let's remember the sacrifice of those people who went in and did what they were told.
Sure.
And didn't question it, and just trusted other people to have made the right call and suffered because of it.
Mm. Now, Tennyson did write a poem, The Charge of the Heavy Brigade, but he wrote it in 1882, by which time the day had gone and there'd been other celebrated successes and failures of the British Army between those times. And the poem really isn't as good. It has the same kind of rhythm, but not quite. And it just didn't catch the public imagination.
So going back to Balaclava, how does it all end?
Dismally, really. Those guns are still being carried away from the forts. Nothing has changed. Scarlett's men have dispersed the cavalry, but he hasn't got to the guns. The infantry still haven't arrived. And so Lord Lucan, who commanded the cavalry, received an order from Lord Raglan. Now, this is one of those great contentious orders of all time. The message, which I've read, is very short. It talks about preventing the enemy from taking away the guns. It talks about French cavalry on your left. In other words, they're there to support you. Get on with it, basically. The message was written in pencil. We've got it in the National Army Museum, and it was carried by an officer called Lewis Nolan, the staff officer, who was a very outspoken critic of the high command. He was an author. He'd written two books on cavalry by this time. He was said to have a very short temper. He was half Italian, half Irish, which was a pretty volatile combination. He'd already given Lord Lucan the title Lord Look-on, because he just looked and did nothing. But Nolan was only a captain. He had no authority, no power at all. He rode down this steep slope, which, by the way, is not as steep as it has appeared in various films. I've been there. I've stood where Raglan stood, and I've seen the route that Nolan took. It's tricky riding, but he was an excellent horseman, could have done it easily. So he rides down. He takes this message to Lucan. Lucan pouts the message to Cardigan, his brother-in-law, who, by the way, he detested. The two men barely spoke to each other for most of the war. But on that day, they were cordial. And Cardigan points out, from his view, lower down, of course, than Raglan's view up on the heights, that there is a valley, which is a cul-de-sac. You've got Russian cannon at the end of it, Russian cannon to each side, Russian cavalry behind those cannon. And he points out that this would be a suicide mission. And Lucan says, yeah, I know that, but unfortunately, it's Raglan's order. The commander-in-chief has said, so we've got to do it. And so off they go. So the five regiments of the Light Brigade move forward to the bugle sound. What happened in the Heavy Brigade was that probably the charge wasn't sounded because it happened so quickly. But this is more measured. This is more straightly. They move forward at a walk, rising to a march, rising to a trot, with the bugle sounding for each one, with Cardigan at their head. The man is 56. He's suffering from asthma and God knows what. But hey, this is his first battle as well, like Scarlet. And he wants to make sure it's a good one. Nolan was riding with them. He asked permission of his friend, William Morris, commanding the 17th Lancers, to ride with the brigade. Morris said yes. And Nolan suddenly realized that they're going the wrong way. They're charging straight down the North Valley instead of veering to the side where the guns and the forts are. Somebody has misunderstood the direction. Whose fault was it? Well, I have to say the system is at fault because you weren't allowed to query commands. But the real culprit, I suppose, has to be Nolan. Because when he gave the message to Lucan, Lucan had said, "What guns?" And Nolan flung his arm behind him, without looking what he was pointing at, and said, "There, my lord, there is your enemy, there are your guns." And of course, he was pointing down the wrong valley. Lucan took him literally, sent the Light Brigade to their destruction. And we don't know how many men rode the charge. My personal view is that it's 678. And of those, something like 250 were killed, same kind of number were wounded, and they lost almost all their horses. In fact, only two horses survived intact at the end of the charge of the Light Brigade without a scratch at all, which is incredible luck.
That's insanity. What are the long-term impacts of the battle for the campaign? Because the ground gets lost, retaken the next day by the Sardinians and the French, doesn't it?
Yep, this is right. The Sardinians, Piedmontese, were our allies too, although they had a very small outfit there. But they did recapture the ground, so the guns were eventually retaken, but not immediately. In the long term, I think the British cavalry frightened the Russians. They weren't going to tangle with them again, and they didn't. There were no other clashes between the British cavalry and the enemy at all for the rest of the war. The only remaining pitched battle was Inkerman, which again was an infantry fight in November. But in terms of the war, nothing was achieved at all by the cavalry action. Even the heroism of Campbell's men and Scarlet's men, because these things ground down. The winter was terrible. Everybody suffered. Men died of frostbite and exposure. They had a cyclone in November where tents and huts were blown away. Horses were blown away. Imagine a horse flying through the air. A terrifying sight that must have been. And until the spring, when a railway was built and reinforcements were sent, and dear old Mary Seacole built her hotel, and Florence Nightingale came out to Scutari, nothing really improved. The British Army is in an absolutely dreadful state. In terms of the very long term, disaster, failure. Okay, Sevastopol was blown up. It was destroyed as a naval base. But guess what? By 1871, it is fully built and functioning again. And again, there is a Russian fleet coming out of the Black Sea, down the Dardanelles, threatening the Eastern Mediterranean. And I think the survivors of all the cavalry units and all the others would have said, well, what was that all about? What did men die for? Because ultimately, as I have to say, with a lot of wars, it achieved nothing.
I mean, you talk about cavalry survivors. Were there many left? I mean, we talk about Charge the Light Brigade. They are, as you say, charging straight into the face of all of that Russian artillery. Two horses get out unscathed. Okay, sure, the heavy brigade have a much more successful story, but you know, these are two, you've got two brigades. One of them has a more typical experience of combat. The other gets ripped apart. So when you say there's not much more in terms of, or there isn't any more in terms of cavalry engagement, is that partly because there's a need to conserve what you've got and you need that kind of lingering threat as opposed to just destroying what remains of that wing of your force?
Yes, Lord Raglan had always said that we must keep our cavalry in a bandbox because he had so few of them. And that mentality continued. Don't risk the cavalry because we don't have enough of them. When reinforcements arrived, largely from India, the 10th Hussars turned up, the 12th Lancers. That makes something of a difference. But you have to remember that Sevastopol is essentially a siege. You wouldn't expect to find many cavalry actions involved in that, but it's all about artillery, it's support from the Navy as well, who are, again, often forgotten in terms of the Crimea. They were doing their bit from the sea. And the whole thing was ended when diplomacy kicked in and peace was agreed. And the Russians, in fact, blew up the base themselves. It wasn't the British who destroyed it. It was the Russians before they pulled out.
What happens to the survivors of the heavy brigade? What are some of their stories beyond Balaclava?
The officers, a lot of them, if they stayed in the army at all, you realise that officers of the infantry and cavalry bought their commission. It was their private property. So they were able to sell it at a profit if they could, in which case they would go back to civilian life. Those who stayed on were by and large promoted. Some of them became majors or lieutenant colonels. A couple of them reached the rank of general. They were celebrated heroes, as you would expect. Those who left went back to their country estates. Most of them were public school boys, a couple of them university men, although there weren't very many of those. Sandhurst, although it existed by 1854, was regarded as being a little bit too common, really, for most of these gentlemen, so they didn't bother to be properly trained. It was all very amateur by modern standards. The other ranks were very different. The ordinary soldiers, some of them stayed on, and again, they'd be promoted, they'd become sergeants or sergeant majors or whatever. One or two of them were promoted to the officer class, but such men were never popular. They felt awkward being among the officers. They couldn't afford the lifestyle, the cost of uniforms, the cost of mess bills was horrendously high, and they were fish out of water, really. And of course, their old mates in the ranks couldn't regard them as friends anymore either, because of the rigid disciplinary system within the army. Flogging wasn't abolished in the army until 1871. So it was a pretty harsh regime. For those who left the army, a lot of them went into, as you might expect, areas of life where they still wore uniforms and still took and gave orders. So they joined the police, they joined the prison service, they joined fire brigades, and made their living as best they could. Some of them became quite celebrated. They gave talks on their reminiscences. A couple of them wrote books. A man named Franks in the 5th Dragoon Guards, who ended up as a regimental sergeant major, he wrote an account which still survives. I used it in one of my sources. But a lot of them, of course, became desperately poor. They ended their days in the workhouse. They had to sell their medals in order to survive and were very quickly forgotten in the majority of instances.
It's a sad end to such an interesting tale. My thank you for coming on and sharing this with us. It's been kind of entertaining and poignant and sad in equal measure. The Charge of the Heavy Brigade, Scarlet's 300 in the Crimea, is out now. I've had the privilege of reading it. Great read. Folks, you can pick it up in the History Hack bookstore. Don't go to Amazon for it, partly because Jeff Bezos Jeff Bezos will skim most of the profit and Mai won't see anything. And if you go to the History Hack bookstore, you not only support Mai, you also support us in producing this show. So you've got, and independent booksellers. So, you know, lots of people benefit. So please do go and buy the book, but buy it through the History Hack bookstore. Link's in the description. And Mai, we're going to have you back at some point to talk about the insanity of the Crimean War more generally. This has been great fun. Thank you.
Thank you, Zach. Thank you, Alex.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.